Welcome to the Delmarva Almanac. Each week, we connect you to the best of Delmarva. I'm your host, Dana Kester McCabe. This week, we'll meet Jan Crumpley and Taylor Collins. They are friends, artists, and entrepreneurs. They also have some interesting stories to tell about Dover's heritage, which we will share with you. In the second half of our show, we'll hear the May Garden Planner, and Dave Wilson will bring us part two in his series on invasive plants. Jan Crumpley and Taylor Collins have channeled their love of art and history into their paintings and the Park Green Galleries on State Street by the Green in Dover.
We got started painting together in the plein air group. After a while, we said, you know, we've got all these paintings, we need a gallery. So we got together with another lady, and we opened up Park Green Galleries in November of 2013.
As a painter, Jan Crumpley focuses on landscapes.
I paint somewhat impressionistically, I like my palette to have, purples, pinks, turquoise in with the landscape to brighten the landscape up. It's not just green and brown, So I like to, even if it's a winter scene, I like to have the atmosphere pop with some nice colors. Well, actually, I specialize in architectural, landscapes, historical components that are really important too. So that's what I do. So I'm not a portrait painter. I can paint pet portraits, but I'd a lot rather do a house portrait, that sort of thing.
Taylor Collins creates collages, the subject of which currently revolve around a theme of love. She says that as a painter, she considers herself to be a folk artist, for now.
I started out doing folk art, and my goal was to emulate Jack Lewis, who was one of our local icons. He liked painting people of the earth, and that's kind of what I do. With my folk art, I try to capture the history of Delmarva. All my prints are very colorful, and they're of the local scenes and things like that. And so then I had a chance to study with Jack for about 10 or 12 years, and he taught me how to plein air paint, and he really taught you how to be an artist. And you tend to learn all the technical stuff, which I never got the hang of. I've only been doing this for about 30 years, so I still can't draw. But one of these days, I hope to get a little bit better at that. But he just gave you the inside scoop on being an artist and what that really entailed. But in the plein air, I really do I'm getting much more expressionistic in that too. I'm getting away from impressionism. You find your way, you really do. You end up but I don't know how to describe it, but you just, you go from one thing to the next. And I think that's what artists really do. We try one medium for a while, then we try another and just keep experimenting. And that's one of the things I really learned from Jack. It's not the finished product, it's the process. And that's what so many people get hung up on. They're so worried about, this perfection aspect of things, and it's got to be perfect, and it's got to be whatever. And not that there aren't heavyweights in the world. I mean, there has to be a Rembrandt, and there has to be a whatever, Picasso or whatever. But the most of us are lightweights, and it doesn't, invalidate you. It's, you still have something worth contributing and worth saying.
As Jan said at the beginning of our story, outdoor painting brought her together with Taylor. They are part of a regional group of plein air devotees, which Taylor helped to get started.
It just grows on you. You just want to get out there and do stuff and try to, get that light. It's all about painting the light anyway. That's what art really is. And so the early morning is the best, I think, and late afternoon. And we paint, now we paint all over, every week. From about the end of March to like the 1st of November, we're out every Wednesday. And anybody in the area that wants to join us can just follow us on Facebook, and they're welcome to come anytime they want.
You do really meet a lot of nice people. It's really fun to get artists that are studio artists and try to talk them into coming out and trying plein air.
I helped found the group that we're in right now, the Plein Air Painters of the Mid-Atlantic. And we started out with, it was four of us. It was Maria Bissett, Donna Hansen, and Diane Bauer and myself. And since then, it's grown to about 50 people. We're on Facebook. And we have one rule, and it's called no rules. We have no rules because we've all done the nonprofits and all that. And so now it's about us and painting.
We don't offer instruction either. That's the other important thing to point out, because we're not going to teach you how to do it. You have to bring some skills to the table yourself. But actually, nothing beats seeing other people doing it to get it right away. So we have seen some younger or less experienced artists come along in the process, and now they're doing some really great work.
If you think you'd like to join the Plein Air Painters of the Mid-Atlantic, visit our website to find a link to their Facebook page. That's also where you can find out more about the Park Green Galleries and its owners, Jan Crumpley and Taylor Collins. But you'll definitely want to visit Park Green Galleries in Dover, which features their work and that of other local artists. Jan also runs the Delaware store, which is at the far end of the galleries, showcasing Delaware-themed gifts and memorabilia. The gallery and gift shop are located in a building dating to the 1820s, which bears the distinction of being the original Golden Fleece Tavern. This was both a pub and the seat of government for Delaware from 1777 to 1791. Anytime you're in that neighborhood and looking for something good to eat, the ladies at Park Green Galleries highly recommend 33 West Ale House or the Gray Fox Grill. A great time to visit will be next weekend during the annual Dover Days Festival held right next door on the Green. This is one of the largest, longest-running free events in the state of Delaware. There'll be a parade, colonial artisans, a maypole dance, and all-day fun for the whole family, capped off with fireworks. Find links and details for this and other cultural events on our website, delmarvaalmanac.com/arts. Because Jan and Taylor's gallery is in a building of historical significance, they have fully embraced a heritage theme with a particular emphasis on women's contributions to our history. So while I was there to ask them about their artwork, they also explained their heritage work. One of the rooms in their gallery is named for famed astronomer and Dover native Annie Jump Cannon. Another is named for one of the first state's great preservationists.
So we named that room the Mabel Lloyd Ridgely Room, because that is Mabel Lloyd Ridgely. It is the Ridgely house next door. That was her house. And the family history goes way back, but she's the woman that we really like in that era. She was she started Old Dover Days, and she saved the old state house because they were going to tear it down when they built the new Leg Hall. So she saved that, and she was real big in preservation. She was a suffragette and all that, and which were all the women that lived on the Green were at that time.
Mabel Lloyd Ridgely was also an artist.
Oh, yeah.
And so the other thing about Mabel, too, is that in 1926, she and her husband, Henry, bought this building, and they reconfigured the Capitol Hotel to be they changed the aspect of it, making it these offices that you see from some of the remaining interior hotel walls. Their family has continuously lived in the Ridgely House next door since 1767, but the family is still there, and they're our landlords, and so we pay homage to them that way, too.
Jan and Taylor often find themselves telling shop visitors the stories of this unique neighborhood. There are quite a few they could tell, but the one they are asked to repeat the most is the story of the chocolate murders. I had never heard this story, so Jan Crumpley filled me in.
What happened was there was two daughters that lived here on the Green of John Pennington, who was a state legislator and a lawyer. The youngest of the two married this man, John Dunning, and he was an AP writer. And so he became head of the AP post in San Francisco State. So he took his bride, Mary Elizabeth, and they went out to San Francisco. They had a child while they were there. But he was basically a philanderer, and this woman that he was seeing grew more and more important to him. And so Mary Elizabeth figured this all out at some point and cut her losses and came back home with the baby to live with her parents here on the Green. And then some time ensued, and And John Dunning ran afoul of the AP, and they said, well, you know, you're not going to run our bureau anymore. We're going to send you to cover the Spanish-American War. You're off to Puerto Rico. So, but he didn't tell his mistress, and her name was Cordelia Botkin. And Cordelia Botkin had a lot of plans up her sleeve, and basically she figured that John Dunning had come back to Dover to reunite with his wife, and if she couldn't have him, nobody would. So, believe it or not, she made arsenic chocolates and was able to mail it in the heat of summer via trains. There weren't planes back then taking the mail to Dover, Delaware. These chocolates were delivered anonymously, and the two sisters ate them and both died. And then there had been other, right, and some children got sick, and a bunny died too.
Yeah.
Anyway, so when Mary Elizabeth died, they called John Dunning back to come and bury his wife, and John Pennington, the father, said she had received these anonymous letters, and what do you know, what do you think about this, and how do you think this came about? And the first thing that the John Dunning, the philandering husband, said was, Cordelia.
This is the Delmarva Almanac. I'm Dana Kester McCabe, and this is the story of the chocolate murders. Naturally, after hearing Jan's story, I had to go find out more. The philandering husband, John Dunning, had made a name for himself covering the devastation of war and natural disaster in Samoa in the South Pacific. Following that harrowing experience, he brought his family to the West Coast to work for the Associated Press. But he and his wife, poor genteel Mary Elizabeth Dunning, were no match for the temptations found in San Francisco, and particularly Cordelia Botkin. After meeting her while riding his bicycle to his office, John was hopelessly drawn into her dissolute world and a circle of wild women. When you hear the names of the players and just a few of the details, you can understand why large crowds gathered to attend the trial and why newspapers across the country made a fortune covering all the dirt. There was Cordelia Botkin herself and her confidant, Mrs. Forcade. Another gal pal was Mrs. Seeley, Cordelia's stepson's girlfriend. And then there was Mrs. Arbogast, who was having an affair with Cordelia's husband. Yes, she too was married. Despite refusing to divorce Mr. Botkin, Mrs. Arbogast had Cordelia's blessing in this union. Though they were never charged, there were accusations that one or more of Cordelia's friends were part of the murder conspiracy. She claimed it was they who had written anonymous notes to Mary Elizabeth Dunning, exposing her husband's wild life of gambling, drinking, and infidelity. Maybe they were the ones who sent the poison candy to Dover. While this may have been the first case of murder by mail in the U.S., Cordelia could have been inspired by a similar incident in Britain where she was raised. The American case was a particular problem for authorities because they couldn't decide whether the crime had been committed in Delaware, where two women died, or in California, where the poison candy was prepared. Finally, it was decided that the trial should take place in San Francisco. The prosecution presented pretty compelling evidence that Cordelia had purchased the poison. But her case was lost when a writer for the San Francisco Examiner named Mrs. Get this, Lizzie Livernash was assigned to befriend Cordelia and investigate the case. Despite knowing the woman was a newspaper reporter, Cordelia took her into her confidence. Though she never confessed to the murder plot, she shared lurid details of her escapades with John Dunning and how she was dedicated to a life of pleasure. Mrs. Livernash, in turn, repeated all this in court. The stories of Cordelia and her friends' outrageous behavior were enough to convince the jury. Cordelia was convicted despite maintaining her innocence. It's not clear where her money came from, but she hired the top defense attorneys in the city, who mounted several appeals. They got her a retrial, but she was convicted again and sentenced to life in prison. John Dunning's responsibility for setting off the terrible chain of events took its toll on him as well. He had to admit in court that he had lost all of his money gambling and that he had dalliances with several other women. He was then jailed during the proceedings for refusing to name them. His writing career was ruined, and not long after the trials, he died of a brain tumor at the age of 44. Meanwhile, Cordelia charmed the guards at the San Francisco jail where she was incarcerated. They allowed her to have extravagant privileges, nice bed linens, good food, and believe it or not, the freedom to come and go from the jail grounds. The very judge who had sentenced her was shocked when he ran into her on a public trolley while she was out for an afternoon ride. This special treatment apparently went on until the earthquake of 1906 wrecked the jail, forcing her and other convicts there to be transferred to the much bleaker existence of San Quentin. This is where she died in 1910, some say of depression. Not all the stories about the stately homes and respected families that have lived on the green in Dover are so lurid. There are many equally fascinating tales of important turning points in the history of our country which happened right there. Monday through Saturday all year long, storytellers at the John Bell House on the Green give free guided walks through Dover's historic district. To find out more about these and the Dover Days Festival, visit this story on our website, delmarvaalmanac.com/history. And now for some Delmarva dates with history for this time period. On May 3, 1898, two freight trains collided near Machapongo, Virginia, derailing four cars. The only injury was a broken arm for a boy named Clarence Parsons, who was stealing a ride from Salisbury. 12 years later, on that same date in 1912, presidential candidate Theodore Roosevelt visited Salisbury, drawing a very large crowd of Maryland and Delaware residents. Many in the crowd were wearing Wilson buttons, so the reception was polite, though not enthusiastic. That election might make you think a little bit about this year's races. Roosevelt won the popular vote in the Republican primary, but was defeated by incumbent President Taft in a contested convention, which led ultimately to Woodrow Wilson being elected president in the general election. It's time for a break now. When we come back, we'll hear the May Garden Planner, and Dave Wilson will bring us part two in his series on invasive plants.
Support for the Delmarva Almanac is provided in part by EatDrinkByArt.com, an online guide to 18 different Delmarva towns and arts districts, where you can purchase your very own masterpiece while enjoying a meal and a night out. For more information about each town and a regional arts calendar, visit EatDrinkByArt.com.
Welcome back to the Delmarva Almanac. Here's Scott Duncan to help you plan your garden activities for May.
During May, things really start to get interesting as the blooming season takes off. Start visiting local public gardens for inspiration. Talk to their staff and make note of what is working for them that you might use in your garden. Look for links to some public gardens on Delmarva on our website. If you are a container gardener, this is the month to start filling those pots. Tried and true annuals like impatiens, vinca major, marigolds, and geraniums are favorite varieties for containers. Local gardeners also report having had great luck in our shore area with coleus, lantana, mandevilla, or sweet potato vine. This is also the time to begin moving your houseplants outdoors. Give them a few transitional days in a protected place before moving them to their intended summer home. This is also a good time to fertilize and, if needed, repot or divide them. During May, plant tender summer bulbs outdoors, such as gladiolas, cannas, tuberose begonias, and dahlias. Once the soil has warmed up enough, you can apply a layer of mulch on flower beds and around trees and shrubs. An easy rule to remember is to mulch once your tulips have faded. Mulch reduces weeds, conserves moisture, and prevents disease. And don't miss those native plant sales sponsored by local environmental groups in our area. Most native plants do best in the ground, but some will also do well in containers. They are all predisposed to thrive in our climate. They take less watering and feeding than other ornamentals, and are therefore an environmentally friendly choice for your landscape. There are several sales here on Delmarva during May. Check our community calendar for dates and links. That's it for this month's planner. Find out more about gardening on the Delmarva Almanac website, where you will find links to hardiness maps and more.
In our astronomy outlook for the coming month, the moon will be new on May 6th, making that the darkest night of the month and therefore a great night for stargazing. The moon will be full on May 21st. Now here's naturalist Dave Wilson with part two of his series of three on the study of invasive plants and their impact on our region.
In the studio, we are lucky to have Curry Kai, the invasive plant ecologist with the Maryland Department of Natural Resources. She is responsible for invasive plant assessment and control on some 475,000 acres of state land. She is chair of the Maryland Invasive Plant Advisory Committee. I want to start today by asking, which species are the most concerned to the state? And are there certain ones that you see as the most insidious?
That is actually a difficult question. We tend not to approach invasive plant species management on a species basis. We approach it on an area basis or a habitat basis. And there's a complement of species that invade particular habitats. So I'm very rarely looking for one individual species that I'm going to work on. That being said, I will say that I would guess that wavy-leaf basket grass is the species that I'm most concerned about right now, primarily because it is so new. Wavy-leaf basket grass is a forest grass. It's perennial. It is stoloniferous, which means it has stolons, which are the stems that lie down along the ground and root at the tips or root at the nodes, which means it spreads vegetatively as well as making seed. It also has an amazing long distance dispersal mechanism. The seeds, the awns, which are bristles on the ends of the seeds, get sticky. And in the fall, anything that walks through patches of wavy leaf basket grass can pull the seeds off the plant, where they stick for as long as months and then drop off in brand new places. So wavy leaf basket grass has only been documented in Maryland and Virginia, which means that without being able to control it, we are afraid it could spread through the entire eastern part of the United States.
Can you talk a little bit about Maryland's new invasive plant law?
In 2011, the state legislature passed a law called the Maryland Invasive Plant Prevention and Control Act. It's part of the Maryland Department of Agriculture law. And it did two essential things. It formed what's called the Invasive Plant Advisory Committee, which is a group of 11 people who advise the Secretary of Agriculture on primarily ornamental plants, things that have come in through horticultural channels and their invasivity. And the second thing it did was to give the IPAC, that's what we call the group, two tasks. One was to choose a risk assessment protocol, and the second was to use that protocol to do risk assessment on a whole suite of potentially invasive plants. So we take the probability from the risk assessment that something is going to be a problem species, and we assign it a tier ranking, either tier one or tier two. Tier one plants will be banned in the state, no longer able to be sold, transported, produced, introduced, transferred. The only thing that's not illegal about a tier one plant is to actually have it. So if you've already got it in your yard, it's not illegal.
Tell us any of the plants that you know of that are going to be on that list.
You bet. There are six species right now. The tier one plants, that is the ones that will be banned. And I didn't tell you yet what happens to tier two plants. But tier one plants, there's one that doesn't exist at all in the state right now. It's called shining geranium, Geranium lucidum. It's a huge problem in Pacific Northwest forests. And it is a plant in the trade, but it's not currently sold in Maryland. And by making it a tier one plant, we keep it out. That's what this law is meant to do, is to prevent. The other two tier one plants are fig buttercup, Ficaria verna, which is that bright yellow flower that you see all over floodplains, especially forested floodplains, very early in the spring. In the next several weeks, it'll be in bloom. And the third is yellow flag iris, Iris sedacaris, which is still sold in the state, not widely sold. Many, many of our Maryland aquatic plant dealers have given it up because they already realize that it's a problem species. But that has been shown, has been documented in the same habitats as some of our rare wetland plants, freshwater wetland plants. And so we got it. Tier two plants. Tier two plants will still be able to be sold, but with very clear, bright yellow signage right next to the displays that indicate that this is a problem species. There's a QR code on the sign that encourages a plant buyer to check out more information, and that will take you to the regulations and the information on MDA's website. And it suggests that you consider alternative plants. What we expect and hope that will happen with tier two plants is that the educated public will understand that these are less desirable species, and eventually the demand for those species will dry up and people will have no incentive to sell them because they can't make any money because nobody wants them.
We've been talking to Curry Kide, the invasive plant ecologist with the Maryland Department of Natural Resources. Next time, we'll talk about how volunteers can get involved to help the state document and control invasive plants in Maryland. For more information on invasive plants on Delmarva and related links, visit us at delmarvaalmanac.com/nature.
Thanks, Dave. Well, that's all for this edition of the Delmarva Almanac. Be sure to follow us on Facebook or Twitter, and next week join us to learn more about our local culture and get connected to our natural wonders. If you'd like to become an underwriter for this program, visit delmarvaalmanac.com/support. We'd like to thank our community partners, the Friends of Delmarva Public Radio, the Community Foundation of the Eastern Shore, and underwriters eatdrinkbyart.com for their help in bringing this program to you, our audience. Our theme music was provided by Brightside Studio. This show has been a Moonshell production. Thanks for listening. Until we meet again, may the rhythms and tides of Delmarva bring you good fortune.